Welcome to St. Louis on the Air and our legal roundtable discussion. I'm Don Marsh. While the grand jury continues its process in the Michael Brown case, legal issues in the Ferguson shooting remain front and center. We'll be talking about them, about court action on same-sex marriage in Missouri, and about the political hot water the state's attorney general finds himself in. And if amendments are put before Missouri voters too often, we'll discuss some ideas for a different approach. Lots of other things to talk about, too. Joining us in studio, attorneys Bill Freivogel, professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor at Washington University and director of the Career Center there. And back with us once again, Peter Joy, Washington University professor of law. He also directs the university's criminal justice clinic. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you all.
Nice to be here. Good morning.
Peter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you. At this stage of the grand jury investigation, how are you looking at this process?
Well, it's been a very long process, as everybody knows, and based on at least what has been reported or leaked, it seems that the grand jury at this point is deciding what they're going to do, and again, based on what's been reported, they started that process on Friday. So to be considering whether or not there's probable cause, which is a very low standard for such a long time, I think causes a lot of people to wonder, well, what's going on?
Yeah, that is a question that comes to mind with regard to, aside from what people are fearing concerning the aftermath or whatever the decision might be, this seems like an inordinate amount of time to be considering this, or is it?
Well, I mean, they've heard a lot more on this case than a grand jury would normally ever hear. And they've heard a lot from individual witnesses where in a regular grand jury proceeding, a chief detective might summarize a lot of testimony. So they've heard a lot. I think that the fact that they haven't come out with the decision indicates, first of all, that they're really taking their job seriously, as I would have expected, and that they're considering it carefully. Beyond that, you know, there's room for speculation. Are they still considering it because they want a unanimous decision, because they think that would be good for the community, or are they fairly closely divided and they feel uncomfortable in returning a no indictment, a no true bill, because they're so closely divided? That, you know, people could speculate about that, other than the fact that I think they're carefully considering their job.
Because only nine have to come together.
That's
so
right.
I think what Peter's saying, yeah, I would think they'd feel much more comfortable they could get it unanimous. And how many African-Americans are on?
It's three.
Three. Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm.
So Bill, how are you looking at? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so this is not your typical grand jury. Yeah, it's longer in time. Hearing all this evidence, as Peter said, the potential defendant, Darren Wilson, the officer, testified. Usually the suspect wouldn't testify, would be advised by a lawyer not to testify. And then we have this promised release of grand jury materials that the St. Louis County prosecutor, Bob McCullough, has made, although that's become a little complicated in the last 24 hours.
We'll go into that. Let's first play a clip of the prosecutor when he was on this program talking about the arrangement that he had made with the judge and the courts with regard to the releasing of the testimony.
And the judge has agreed that, first of all, if there is an indictment of any charge, then all the information will come out during the course of the prosecution. If there is no indictment, normally it's a closed record, it's a closed file, unless the judge agrees to release it. And the judge has told me that she will order that everything be released. So everything will be, and it will be, I don't know about simultaneously, but very, very close in time.
St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough appearing on this program just a couple of weeks ago. Well, that's what he was saying then. It's a different story today, Bill.
Yeah, well, over the weekend, the court administrator, Paul Fox, said that, you know, Judge Whittington had not issued an order, and that Judge Whittington would need some time to weigh, you know, the reasons for releasing and against the considerations for keeping some of the evidence a secret. I mean, you know, normally the evidence before a grand jury is secret. And I guess the kinds of things that would come into play is if certain kinds of testimony was released Would people be able, even if it were released without the names of the witnesses, would that then be would the witnesses still be identifiable in some way? And then could they be potentially put in danger?
Yeah, Peter.
Yes, though I think, you know, it's possible that the original statement by Mr. McCullough is true, and what Bill is saying basically explains that you could have a presiding judge, in this case Judge Whittington, saying, well, yeah, I'll release information, but she or no reasonable judge is going to sort of write a blank check. They'd want to see and make the considerations that Bill's talking about. And the other thing is, at this point, we don't have a decision. So if it's no indictment, it would be or an indictment, it would be premature to say, well, I'm going to release it. You know, I want to see what the decision is if I'm the judge.
Mark, what do you think about the timing of this particular new information coming out? It would seem to some that I've talked to that this should have come out maybe a few weeks ago instead of on the cusp of the announcement.
I wish I could give you some great insightful. I mean, I was surprised by it as well. The only thing I can think of, and I'd be interested in what others think too, is that, you know, they had a conversation and kind of we should make this public. If there's no indictment, yeah, I agree, but maybe they didn't go into the details, and now that it's becoming more likely that it's going to happen right now, you know, the judge may be saying, by the way, you know, I got to look at this, and I don't know. But that's the only thing I can think of that would explain it.
We've had a number of emails and tweets from people asking the same question. McCullough's been saying this since late September. That's when the piece you just heard aired in our air. Why would the judge wait until now to issue this clarification? I guess we'll never know, like so much associated with all of this. And, Peter, you've used the word speculation. There's so much speculation going on in this case, which I guess a lot of folks think is very, very harmful to the whole process, and particularly to those waiting for whatever action they're going to take.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's been this much speculation because of two things. First of all, the amount of time that's transpired, and secondly, the great interest that the media has had. And so the media keeps on asking people, and so people keep on speculating things, and the speculation gets in the newspaper, and then in everyday conversation, everybody starts speculating.
Well, Bill, you're a professor of journalism, a longtime journalist, as well as an attorney. What do you think about the way this has been presented? Let's start with the national media presenting this story.
Well, I think at this particular moment, I am so tired of the stories saying that, you know, day after day after day about the Ferguson, that we're all, you know, anxiously awaiting the grand jury's decision. I mean, we are anxiously awaiting it. But, I mean, do we have to hear about it every single hour and do all the little runners underneath the cable news programs, you know, state of emergency in Ferguson, true. But, you know, then I hear, a woman saying, well, she's not going to be stuck in her house. She's going to go outside. I mean, of course you're going to go outside. I mean, people in the rest of the country must think that we're all have bought our guns and blockaded ourselves in our houses and that outside the streets are burning. I mean, what? Have there been maybe, I think the Post-Dispatch had a story, two places were looted and burned back in August. The exaggerated idea that I think is being portrayed to the rest of the country is, I think, very distorting.
One of the things that struck me in that Post-Dispatch article was the fact there's more damage been done by the most recent hailstorm in Ferguson than by the protests. Mm-hmm. I mean, this says an awful lot, it would seem to me.
I mean, I don't want to underestimate. We could face really difficult days ahead if there's a decision not to prosecute Darren Wilson. And we are all – it is a really big story. But, you know, to a certain extent, what happens is the national news, you know, I don't know how many people, six people for the New York Times, all the national organizations have got multiple people in town, and they are expected to have a story. And so, you know, the story is anxiously awaiting, you know, and speculating about why didn't they do it on Sunday and why didn't they come up with a decision on Friday. And it's just speculation upon speculation, and it really doesn't help anyone. It'd be nice to serve.
And there also been, and I don't know if this was in an article you did or I read it somewhere else, but just factual inaccuracies. Somebody saying that Ferguson borders Clayton, or somebody else was talking about local people doing live remotes, but it turns out they're, when you look closely, you realize, no, they're just in front of the TV station. They're not in this, but the implication is I'm here on the streets telling you what's going on, and I don't think that helps things.
I'm surprised some of them weren't done on the Tam overpass, which is one of the most famous places in town for doing that sort of thing. Another issue that has come up, and Bill, you've written about this, and I don't think many people fully understand the Missouri law with regard to use of force on the part of police officers. It's not what most people suppose. Why don't you tell folks exactly how it's approached?
Okay. Now, I may oversimplify a little bit because it's sort of complicated. So 30 years ago, the Supreme Court said in a case called Tennessee versus Garner that it was unconstitutional for police to use deadly force to shoot and kill a fleeing unarmed suspect. But Missouri never changed its law. The Missouri law permits a police officer to use deadly force to stop a fleeing unarmed felon. So those two things are in conflict. But then to add to the conflict, the Missouri Supreme Court adopted a jury instruction which is consistent with a Supreme Court decision. In other words, you can't shoot an unarmed fleeing felon. So the question is, if there were a trial of Darren Wilson, couldn't he still rely on the Missouri statute which says you can shoot a fleeing felon? Now, Peter, in the story I wrote, Peter, and he can speak for himself, points out that all this becomes just sort of a law school exercise if, in fact, Michael Brown stopped, turned around, put up his arms, and was trying to surrender. He's no longer a fleeing felon.
And felon is the key word here. I mean, it would have to be a felony.
Well, yeah, either committed a felony or attempted to commit a felony. That's right. And as I told Bill before, if Michael Brown was surrendering or he was incapacitated, you know, he wasn't going after the officer, he was falling to his knees or something, and it was clear to a reasonable person, somebody in Darren Wilson's position, that he was no longer a threat, then his, you know, even under this provision that arguably – you know, may or may not still be valid in Missouri, you know, he's not authorized to continue shooting. And that I think, from the beginning has been the key issue in this case. And if it goes to trial, if there is an indictment, which you need before you go to trial, that'll be the key issue in that case as well.
I have to take a break in a moment, but we have a caller who can't stay very long. Let's get him in before that break and see what Tom has to say in St. Louis. Go ahead, Tom.
Thanks, Don. What does your panel think of the Amnesty International comment on that state use of force law? Did they get it right? And how embarrassing is that for Missouri and St. Louis to have that international voice, bringing to light this inconsistency in our laws?
Who would like to take that, Bill?
I have to confess I haven't actually seen the Amnesty Internet. I know they've been very involved. I didn't see what they actually said about this. I'm sort of relying on my own research on this. I apologize.
Amnesty International did point out, just as you discussed a moment ago, that this law in Missouri is a little bit different. And Mark?
No, I was just going to say, you know, assuming this facts situation and you know, we're speculating. We don't know what the facts are, but you can't talk about the law without tying the facts down to a particular situation. I mean, the thing with the Tennessee case was it was a civil rights action. And so this would be using this law as a defense to a criminal charge. So I think there are two legal ways you could either say, well, because the Supreme Court said this kind of is unconstitutional in a civil lawsuit, that the law is kind of basically nullified and then it wouldn't apply at all. Or you could say, like some people have said, well, you're talking apples and oranges, that and it would still apply in the criminal case. So like you said, it's kind of an interesting, almost like a law school exam type question.
Yeah, and I guess the bigger issue and the issue for the Missouri State Legislature to decide and people that feel strongly about this should get in touch with their representatives is, should the Missouri law state, even if it might not be able to be used in court, that a police officer can fire at a fleeing felon, somebody running, and shoot the person in the back because based on this law, there's an argument that's what you're entitled to do. And should police officers being able to shoot unarmed people when they're fleeing, is that a reasonable use of force?
I have to take that break, but my understanding is that in this particular case, Michael Brown, given the incident in the cigar store with the cigars in this convenience shop, that it looked like he might have committed a second-degree felony. Is that correct? So, therefore, he would fall under this
Well, and also
umbrella.
It depends on what happened at the police car.
And I wouldn't go on the convenient food store issue at all. I mean, first of all, it's up in the air. The chief of police at Ferguson said Officer Wilson didn't know about it. But I think Officer Wilson, if he's going to rely on the fleeing felon part of this, would be based on what happened at the car. Because if you assault a police officer, it's going to be a felony.
And we wonder why the grand jury is having a hard time putting all these pieces together. Let's take a break now. We'll come back and continue our conversation. This is our Legal Roundtable Day. My guests in studio are Peter Joy from Washington University, Bill Freivogel from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and Mark Smith, also of Washington University. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our legal roundtable discussion in just a moment. But first, these are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A committee called Prescription Drug Monitoring Program Now plans to launch a campaign for the 2015 legislative session to put a prescription drug monitoring program in place. Vandals have spray-painted anti-police graffiti on the statue in the Shaw neighborhood called Naked Truth. The graffiti was discovered there in the Compton Hill Reservoir Park this morning. And Illinois public universities are getting a budget warning from the head of the Board of Higher Education. He's telling schools to get ready for state funding cuts of up to 30%. His warning follows a meeting with Governor-elect Bruce Rauner's budget transition team. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Back to our roundtable discussion now. And anything else that you gentlemen want to say about Ferguson before we move on?
I just might add on that point, the point we're just talking about the Missouri law that's out of line with the Supreme Court decision, that law is still on the books. And a question that we will get, I think, an answer from McCullough on is, so what did he tell the grand jury the law was? McGee, his spokesperson, said that when they make the announcement on the grand jury that they will answer this question as to did they instruct the grand jury that the Missouri law was valid and that's what they should consider.
Before we move on to other things, unless
well,
you've
the, got the other thing about this decision, and I tried a few cases, not a lot, but it's my experience that people tend to make decisions like between 4:30 and 6 because they want to go home, and Friday afternoon people get motivated, and I got to believe nobody would want this hanging over them over Thanksgiving, you know. So I could see people saying it'd be nice to get a unanimous decision, but then by Wednesday saying, you know, 10 to 2 is good enough.
Can anybody say, whether it be Bob McCullough, the judge, or anybody else say, look, okay, you've reached your decision, but we're not announcing it until next week? I mean, can that happen just to get through the holidays, even though people are eagerly awaiting this decision?
Sure. And grand jury decisions happen often that don't get announced, the moment that it happens, right, especially where there are other people that are defendants in the case and they want to get them all put together or for other reasons. So that's within the discretion of the judge and the prosecutor.
So they could come to a decision today and someone can say, okay, good, we've got the decision. Next Monday's the day we're going to announce it.
I think it's very possible. And I think we're already awfully close to Thanksgiving.
And Black Friday.
Black Friday. We don't want to interrupt all that shopping, right?
Right.
And the fact that Judge Whittington has now said through this spokesperson that she is going to need to do this balancing. I mean, so is this a balancing that's going to have to occur in connection with all the main witnesses? Testimony. I mean, that could be a really, if it's an individualized kind of decision like that, that could take a lot of time. So, I mean, the only other example we have of that I know of the release of grand jury evidence was the Jack in the Box case back in Berkeley, you know, about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago.
Which has sullied Bob McCullough's reputation.
Yes, it has. Yeah, but it, I mean, it was months after the decision. I mean, there was a grand jury decision. There was a federal grand jury decision. Then there was a request for the transcripts in months, I think weeks passed. So this is really a very special situation where at least McCullough has given the impression that it would be almost, I think in your clip, almost immediate. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, they've sent out the codes, you know, to the news organizations. Mm-hmm. Here's where you look, you know, on your computer to get this information. But this is a very special kind of case. But I think the fact that Whittington's says she's going to look at this more carefully, that could delay things further.
Let's take a call from Malcolm calling from Florissant, and then we'll move on unless something pressing comes up. Go ahead, Malcolm.
My comment regards the culture within the police force about how to treat fleeing felons. I've been looking at some of the police blogs that are supportive of Darren Wilson, and they have comments in there that are very unsettling. Comments such as, thank you, Officer Wilson, for taking out the garbage. Thank you, Officer Wilson, for saving the state of Missouri the cost of a trial. Thank you, Officer, for one less person, one less criminal we have to worry about. And this goes to the heart of excessive use of force and the way that the state of Missouri are backing up that kind of behavior by lowering the bar to the point where there's no reason to give an officer pause when he pulls his gun. He can draw, he can shoot, he can kill, and he knows he can get away with that. And that's not the kind of police force I want. Today, they're hitting shooting at black unarmed youth. In the future, it could be just any teenager, or it could be anybody that's running away. And it could be you or me, who just doesn't hear what they're telling us to do, or is running from what we think is a problem without realizing it's the policeman that's talking to us.
I think you make a good point, and you know those kinds of racist attitudes that you read on those kinds of social media, you know, are very disturbing. There's very disturbing social media messages on the other side as well, such as what do we want to happen to Darren Wilson? We want him dead. So out there on the social media, you're going to find an awful lot of very disturbing attitudes.
Yeah, and also, too, I guess it might be a blog that's associated with police or people supporting police, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's police officers that are posting that. And so that could be reflecting just a very bad element of our society.
I mean, I think, anonymous boards bring out sometimes the worst people and the worst of people. I know the Cop Talk blog, the last time I looked at it last week, it had been – you had to have a password. So they – and I know in the past they have sometimes deleted posts. I think the moderators, who I understand are no longer police officers but former ones, are trying to – they don't want that kind of stuff either. But having said all that, I do think that it's quite possible that there will be some rethinking of police training and what's appropriate in different situations. I mean, that could be one of the few good things that comes of this, is that we have a more – robust discussion of it, and I don't think anyone wants to put police officers in danger, but at the same time, we want to make sure that there's buy-in for the kind of force we're authorizing police officers to use in different situations.
I have an email here from Bob Grievecourt. Can your panel address the following observation made by Benjamin Crump, one of the attorneys for the Brown family? Instructions to a grand jury almost always use a probable cause standard for issuing an indictment. Why is it this grand jury, though, is hearing all of the evidence from both sides almost like a trial in order to issue an indictment?
That goes back to what Mr. McCullough said at the beginning. He said this grand jury was going to hear everything. In the typical case, the prosecutor already has charged somebody and brings a specific charge, not an array of charges, to the grand jury, and only presents enough evidence to get probable cause, which is a very, very low standard. So this goes back to an observation that Bill made at the start of the program, just another one of the unusual features of this grand jury.
All right. Well, I want to move on to some other things, but there are two calls here that I'll take. If we can make them very quick, starting with Jerry in St. Louis. Go ahead, Jerry, but please make it quick. We want to move on.
Hey there. Sure. Actually, I'm driving around Forest, and as we speak, I think the thing that's kind of disturbing to me is in discussing timing of the release, I can understand perhaps wanting to shield Thanksgiving because that's an important national family holiday. But when we start talking about Friday because of shopping, doesn't that seem to cheapen and hold us all hostage to a very important decision on an important topic for the sake of retailers having their big Black Friday event?
Jerry, thanks for the call.
Yes, it does. I totally agree. That doesn't mean it won't end up being a consideration. But I totally agree with you. If they have it ready, they should announce it on Friday. Retailers, shouldn't be considered.
There's still a little time between now and Christmas, as if my calendar is correct. Thanks for the call, Jerry. Very quickly, Bob and Milstadt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. It seems to me that your panel is ignoring the root cause for the frustration in the community, and that's the municipal court system and the use of fines to fund communities and police salaries. I know when I was in the military stationed in Georgia many, many years ago, we were warned about speed traps in the community, and if you had an out-of-state license plate, you were going to be stopped. And I see this occurring in the St. Louis metropolitan area, especially around Lambert Airport and other places. The use of fines to generate funds to maintain these small municipalities.
Bob, thank you for the call. Don't mean to interrupt, but that was going to be my next question for you, gentlemen, because there is an attempt at discussion about reform.
Right, and the caller's absolutely right. The nature of the protests that we've had, how long they've gone on, and the messages that they've been having, this is much bigger than the death of Michael Brown. And it has to do with systemic racism, and it also has to do with issues of these municipalities, as the caller points out, that basically have turned their law enforcement agencies into their ATM machines instead of going ahead and, you know, having a proper tax base and raising taxes if that's what they need to do.
There are a couple of organizations, and the law department of St. Louis University and the Arch City Defenders have gotten into this thing. And Mark, one of the things that is being talked about is using public defenders or volunteers to basically work with the people who find themselves in this position in these municipalities facing warrants and fines and
Right. So there's this guy, Thomas Harvey, who's the arch defender guy, and then Frank Vaderot, who's one of the judges. And I think that they both kind of agree, public defenders. I think Vaderot would like to see volunteers from the law school, law students. And Harvey says, no, we've got to have real public defenders. We've got to pay them and everything. But that would add to the cost. There was also this Better Together report talking about all these different municipalities having prosecutors and judges and overlap, where you might have a lawyer who acts as a prosecutor in municipality A, who's a judge in B, and it provides the appearance of impropriety. So I think, this balkanization of the county into all these municipalities, it affects this, but it also affects things like the other services we provide. It's just not the most efficient way to do it. But didn't we have an effort in the late 80s to redo this? I remember there was an election, and I remember hearing elected officials say, I don't care. Even though it's good government, I'll lose my seat. I'm not going to support it. And I remember thinking, God, that's just so it's just so short-sighted.
The county presiding judge, Maura McShane, has said that she would put together a committee or is working with a committee of judges and lawyers to look at this thing. Do we have any idea where that stands now?
That's Frank Vaderot's committee. Yeah, Frank Vaderot is in charge of that committee, and they're making progress. I mean, I think this is the good news is I think this is an area where there is actual reform underway, and there's going to be changes. Mm-hmm. Frank Vaderot has sent around the messages to a few of the courts that were not following all the rules and gotten that straightened out. As Mark says, he wants to have some volunteer public defenders. He's talking about an amnesty that you'd have to pay $100 and then you would get a new court date. Thomas Harvey, very different sort of fellow, young St. Louis University graduate, Arch City defenders. He says, you know, first of all, this committee of veterans should have representatives of people who actually end up as defendants in municipal courts, that we should have a real public defender system, that if it's just volunteers, there won't be a lawyer-client relationship. There won't be any kind of a, you know, if this volunteer makes a mistake, then you can't sue him for malpractice. You know, won't be a real lawyer.
Sure.
And, you know, paying $100 to get an amnesty, that's not a real amnesty. It should be, they should just wipe the slates clean. As for the money question that Mark was raising, you know, the money of the public defenders, well, he says, Harvey says they're bringing in a lot of money to the municipality. Just use some of that money to pay for the public defenders.
Peter Joy, aside from the demand on the part of the protesters and others for, quote, justice in the Michael Brown case, it seems to me that this is the issue that has rankled people the most.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I mean, and it's the, you know, a lot of people say if not for these policies, Darren Wilson may never have stopped Michael Brown and his companion, who were walking not on a thoroughfare, but a small street, not a lot of traffic. Mm-hmm. And people walk in the middle of the street where I live all the time, and the police don't go out of their way to stop them either. So that's an issue. But I do want to make one correction. If there are lawyers volunteering to represent anyone, they can still be sued. They still have the same ethical obligations, whether they're doing it for free or whether they're getting paid $500 an hour. So, I think Bill might have summarized what Mr. Harvey had said.
Well, but the proposal that is being made is for that it would be set up with the Missouri legislature passing a law that would say there would be no malpractice in this instance.
Well, they might pass that law, but I don't see that law standing, because when it comes to the professional obligations of lawyers, it's the Missouri Supreme Court that has the final say.
On the ethical duties of lawyers, right?
On the ethical duties, that's right. And so even if they're removed from the civil liability, and thanks for clarifying that, and I misunderstood that, they still have the ethical obligation, and if they violate it, they could lose their license
right.
And you know, I don't know too many lawyers who don't care about holding on to their law license.
Sure. Right.
Have to take another break. We'll do that now and come back and continue our legal roundtable discussion. We have a number of things I'd like to get to as time allows. My guests in studio, as usual, Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith. And also joining us once again is Peter Joy from Washington University. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. As we continue our conversation, our legal roundtable panel discussion for today, we have an email from Sheila, and again, I want to move on, but she just raises something that I think we've talked about before, is regardless of what the grand jury does in conjunction with the Michael Brown case, Officer Wilson is still potentially subject to civil action.
Right, civil action, and also there's still the possibility of a federal civil rights criminal charge, although, you know, that's something that is a whole separate process.
And that investigation is taking place.
Yes.
He could also be disciplined by the Ferguson Police Department. I mean, that's not outside the realm of possible.
If he stays with the department.
Yeah,
he's talking
right
now about a buyout of some sort,
right,
about his negotiating his withdrawal from that. Let me get to a couple of other things. I wanted to bring up the gay marriage issue. It seems to be something we talk about every time on this. But Missouri now has two cases, one in St. Louis and one in Kansas City, that are being appealed at various levels, one to the state Supreme Court, one to the federal court. But in Cincinnati, and the issue here is the fact that the judges have struck down the ban on same-sex marriage. However, a case in Cincinnati in which a judge upheld the ban, does this mean we're right on track for the Supreme Court or not?
It's putting us closer to that, because there's now developing a circuit split, and that's one of the key features that the Supreme Court takes into consideration when they decide to hear cases.
So we might be right in the middle of that.
We could be, and it could happen. It could still happen this Supreme Court term. One thing that's sort of interesting is that the Supreme Court is generally not delaying the effect of decisions striking down state laws banning same-sex marriage. So they're letting to clarify that they're letting marriages go ahead, and there are now. I mean, the last two states were South Carolina and I believe it was Montana. So they are numbers either 34 or 35 or 35 and 36 somewhere.
Mid-30s.
And you know, the Supreme Court, they're not issuing decisions in these cases, but they're just saying we're not going to put the process on hold. And these actions are being taken over the objection of, I believe it's Scalia and Thomas. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, pretty soon we're going to have something close to a fait accompli.
Right.
I just don't wonder why, if a Supreme Court really has in mind that they might rule that there's not a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, why would they let these marriages go forward?
They can kind of punt on this, can't the justices, and just let the states do what they're doing?
Well, they started down that road, and there are some people that were actually, you know, thinking it was an intentional strategy, because
right.
One of the criticisms of Roe versus Wade, which has developed into a very divisive issue in this country, was that the Supreme Court acted too soon, that if they had let states deal with it on their own, that a clear majority or supermajority might have emerged, and then they could have gone ahead and done something more consistent with what most people were thinking. But here, a lot of these states have had their laws struck down by federal courts, not just the, you know, not state Supreme
right.
courts. And so I think it started off as kind of a mixed bag to begin with, but it's definitely an issue that eventually they're going to have to address, because there is this split that's developing among the federal district courts.
I mean, it is possible they could say, okay, we're going to wait for another circuit to rule like the Sixth Circuit and say that these laws are constitutional. So, you know, maybe they would wait for the Eighth Circuit or something to do that.
Well, it's a waiting game, and we'll therefore
we'll
wait. Stay tuned, as we love to say in radio. Okay. Anyone have any comment with regard to the Chris Koster story, the New York Times story, basically saying he was involved in some sort of pay-to-play scheme for campaign donations and kind of looking the other way with regard to his office investigating a couple of major corporations? He has since announced that he is taking a different ethical approach to all of this, will not accept such donations. Thoughts?
Well, my reaction is it just reflects how bad the campaign finance laws are in Missouri,
right.
as well as the nation. But we also have, individuals who get millions of dollars, literally, from single contributors who have their own political agenda, and nothing happens. And Missouri legislature, has ducked this issue time and time again. And so I think it's a little ironic that they're going to set up some kind of investigation into Koster when, if you took a look at their own practices, they should be shamed and humiliated.
How often can you say Rex Singfield, for instance?
Well, you mentioned his name.
I mean, I think Koster looked quite bad in the New York Times story.
Yeah.
Now, I know he says that there are some things that were misleading, although I've been having trouble finding exactly what he's talking about. I mean, it seems like he instructed the staff, to not proceed on some investigations around the time that he was getting campaign contributions. And from, in general, lawyers who were representing companies like Pfizer and AT&T and some sort of power drink. And I think that looks bad. Apparently, it seems like his proposals for how he's going to change his ethical conduct are good ones, that he won't take those kind of contributions if it's within 90 days of a decision that his office is making. It seems like they're stronger than the ethics that are being applied to other to other state attorneys general. So that's a good step.
Hmm. He is running for governor. Mark Smith, how damaging do you think this might be for his political future?
I don't know. I mean, that New York Times article is pretty bad, but I don't see any other candidates kind of coming out. I mean, it's been kind of assumed he would be the candidate, I think. Not that I have inside information or anything. So I think he'll continue unless somebody decides to take him on, and I don't see that coming out. You got a couple of people. Who do you think?
I was interested in that last line in a story that I think Joe Manis wrote that Claire McCaskill was considering running in 2016, and then they had a quote from her. Which was sort of, I'm sure that Koster will, you know, be taking this to heart or something. It's sort of a, and of course we have Hanaway as the state auditor. So there, he could face some real tough opposition.
He could face Republic. But do you really think Claire McCaskill would run? Why would you give up being a United States Senator?
She apparently wants to be governor. I mean, I read this time and time again.
Such a thankless job.
She never wanted to go to Washington. I mean, she always wanted to be governor, and I guess I figured that having spent time in Washington, she might have changed her mind, but I'm not at all surprised if she wants to be governor instead of a senator.
There's also a piece I saw somewhere today suggesting, and this is out of the piece, and I can't attribute it because I've forgotten where I read it, but that she is behind the leak that put this story in the New York Times about Mr. Koster. So, you know, politics, strange bedfellows.
I read that in Bill McCullen's column today.
It was someplace else, too. It wasn't okay. Bill McCullen's column. Well, it was someplace else.
All I can say is if that's true, I wish she'd leaked it to me.
Well, I'm just hoping that, like Peter said, that we get some real ethics laws in Missouri. I mean, it's just terrible what we have. I mean, that we have nothing. And it's just – it's embarrassing. And it really undermines our democratic process. It's just – terrible. And that combined with the term limits, and I know we went into that with good intentions, but it just seems like we're the power is going away from the people towards moneyed interests.
Our recommendations today then are for new use of force legislation and new ethics legislation. I hope the lawmakers are taking notes.
They're probably taking notes.
Undoubtedly. Yeah, sure. Something along these lines that is worth talking about, at least briefly, because time is getting away, and that are proposals made by Mike Wolff. He, like a lot of people, are concerned about the plethora of constitutional amendments that the Missouri voting public are faced with cycle after cycle. And he has some ideas for limiting the number of constitutional amendments put forth. Who would like to discuss what Mr. Wolff has said? He's proposing, among other things, two votes in order to pass any of these proposals.
Yeah, I noticed that proposal. I think Mike is totally right in saying that the state constitution Missouri state constitution is way too hard, way too easy to amend, and it only requires a 50% vote of the electorate, as opposed to the U.S. Constitution. There are supermajorities required at several levels of the process. I think it's a good idea to make it harder. And I don't know if the two-vote thing would work. I think his thinking is that, okay, we have a totally different electorate in an off-year a midterm election than we do in a presidential election, and as we just saw demonstrated. And so you should have to be – if you're going to amend the state constitution, you should be able to have to get it passed with both of those electorates. And so it makes some sense. I wonder if you just couldn't set up a supermajority.
Right. Well, that the whole idea is to get more people involved in the process as opposed to slipping them in during the off-year elections.
Right. And one of the things I always find troubling is that sometimes there'll be a constitutional amendment that will pass. I mean, that won't pass. So it doesn't pass. But then the state legislature really wanted it. So they took the constitutional amendment route first because they thought, well, this would be a way where we don't have to take the responsibility.
It bypass the governor.
Yeah, that's right. Right. And then they go ahead and they pass it. Now, I'm thinking of back when the right to carry law was there. You know, majority of people in the state said no, but the state legislature said yes.
And that's happened a couple of times. I mean, it happened with the puppy mills thing, where they revised things, and with campaign financing that we were just talking about. I think the people passed something, and the state legislature said none of that.
Yeah, there have been 30, almost 40 proposed constitutional amendments over a relatively brief period of time in Missouri. Seems like an excessive number to a lot of people.
Right, and some of them are just like these really long page upon page upon page.
Right.
I'd like to actually see the hard copy version of the Missouri Constitution. It must be a big stack of papers. Not something you can put in your pocket.
And you wonder if the legislators have read all of those papers because sometimes they don't do that. Quickly, just a couple of minutes left. Okay. Get out your crystal balls and let's find out if the U.S. Supreme Court is going to gut Obamacare.
I think it all depends on Chief Justice Roberts.
That's
the key. So this all comes to the question of is the way the legislation was drafted. One part of it seems to say that if a state doesn't set up a health care exchange, the federal government can set one in its stead, and that would then the people in it would qualify for the subsidies as is currently the case. But then another part of the law says that the subsidies are for the state exchanges. So the question is, you know, if we have this conflict, what is in fact the case? And it seems pretty clear that the four justices who voted to throw out the Obamacare a couple of years ago are the ones who decided to. They are the four votes that were necessary to bring this case before the Supreme Court. And maybe I've seen speculation that what they're trying to do is put Chief Justice Roberts on the hot seat. It was his vote that saved Obamacare a couple of years ago. And, you know, conservatives are going to be pressing hard for him to take a different position.
He's apparently been taking a lot of flack from within the court itself, from the conservative justices.
Right. Who was in the Ashcroft Justice Department, specifically said that this was an opportunity for Chief Justice Roberts to make up for his previous mistake. I mean, Peter said earlier, usually the Supreme Court takes something when there's a split amongst the circuits. So, well, there really isn't a split here. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said that the way the law was, you know, that we have an ambiguous statute, so we have to look at what was intended, and what was intended was for the subsidies to be available where the feds had set up the exchange. And then even though a panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals had thrown it out, that has been vacated by the full D.C. Court of Appeals, which now is controlled by Obama judges. But obviously, the four justices on the Supreme Court says we're not going to wait for them to agree with the Fourth Circuit. We're just going to take this case.
Peter?
Yeah, well, the thing that I ask myself is if they threw out the Affordable Care Act, I still like to use its regular name. Mm-hmm. So what would then happen to all these people with prior existing conditions that couldn't afford health care before? And does anyone think that this Congress – where the new Congress that will come in could pass anything? And so then there will be all these people who, for the first time in their lives, had health care insurance they could afford, and the safety net is dropped, and they're now back into maybe even a worse situation than they were before, and Congress is just going to sit by and twiddle their thumbs like they've been doing. So, you know, I hope that the Supreme Court doesn't take the case, or if they do, I mean, if they make the decision because they have taken the case, that they don't throw it out, because if they do, they're going to be throwing literally millions of people into chaos.
Mark, this is the same kind of box that Congress is in with regard to immigration. I wanted to at least mention that in Mr. Obama's speech of last week, because if these people are given a couple of years of breaks of the kind he described, that's going to be tough to undo.
Right, right. And so, yeah, so and it would be difficult for Congress to undo. It also might be difficult for a new president to undo, which is also possible. On that case, the immigration one, the question, because people are saying it's illegal for him to do that, I think the issue is it, you know, Obama's justifying by saying it's like prosecutorial discretion. You can't go after all these people, so let's go after the most dangerous and the parents of kids who are U.S. citizens, let's make those a lower priority. But they're also giving them work authorization, so that muddies it. And then I think what's really incensing people is some of Obama's previous comments where he kind of said, I couldn't do that if I wanted to, and now he's doing it.
But I think Obama has a very strong constitutional argument that he's operating under prosecutorial discretion. There are 11 million illegal immigrants in the country. The U.S. government, deports 400,000 a year. Doesn't it make sense to not be deporting the parents of U.S. citizens.
Well, we have three lawyers here. We have 30 seconds left. Peter Joy, did he act illegally?
I don't think so.
All right.
If he did, then Ronald Reagan did, and a lot of
Bush,
other presidents did,
Bush,
too.
Right.
Yes.
And Bill Frevel, I think you just answered the question.
Right. I think he's in
comment.
Compliance with the Constitution.
Yep. I think he is, too. But the conservative attack on him is that he has a duty, shall execute the laws, and he's specifically saying, I'm not going to execute it against this group. And that's what's getting people worked up. But well, I agree. I think he's okay.
If there was the suggestion of a kumbaya moment after the last election, and I'm not sure there was. It's
so.
Gone now, don't you think? Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. That ends our legal roundtable discussion for today. Peter Joy, great to see you again.
Yeah,
thanks
thank
for
you
being
very
with
much.
Us. Bill Frevel, always a pleasure. Mark Smith, same to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the Affordable Care Act in light of the current open enrollment period. We'll also check in with St. Louis Public Radio Washington correspondent Jim Howard for an update of issues of local interest in our nation's capital. We'll ask him about Claire McCaskill's intentions. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.